Francisco, and it gives me really great pleasure to introduce this event about copyright history, which is being hosted by CREATE, the RC UK Centre for Copyright Law. This is a two-day event. We're going to start today with a lecture delivered by Professor Tomás Gómez. This is a lecture that's available open not just to academics, but also to the general public. And Tomás is going to present a publicly accessible version of his very complex research about the origins of copyright law and that have just been published in the Connecticut Law Journal. So based on extensive original archival work, Tomás is seeking to displace existing opinion by distinguished academics, some of which are sitting in this very room, all about the origins of copyright law. Then tomorrow morning we've got the second half of the event. A panel of five heavyweight legal scholars, so leaders in the field, are going to rigorously scrutinise Tomás's claims in a panel discussion with the provocative title, What is the Point of Copyright History? So, what are the claims that Tomás makes? Has he presented sufficient evidence to make out these claims and displace existing opinion? And does and should such academic work on copyright history influence how we think about copyright law today? These are just some of the questions that we're going to be thinking about over the next 2 days. So with this introduction, let me hand over the floor to Tomás for Copyright at Common Law in 1774.
Well, thank you very much. So let me begin by thanking Ronan and Martin, Elena and Diane for making this event possible. And also I especially want to thank Howard Abrams, who's here with us, and Mark Rose and Ronan, with whom I disagree with in this paper a bit, for being such great sports about it. So the subject of my talk concerns the origins of Anglo-American copyright law and focuses exclusively on English law circa 1774. In a nutshell, we will discuss whether English jurists in the late 18th century believed that copyright originated as a common law right or as a privilege created solely by statute in 1710, which is the year the first modern-like Copyright Act, the Statute of Anne, was enacted. That statute limited copyright to a maximum term of 28 years. Central to our discussion will be the case of Donaldson v. Becket, a House of Lords decision from 1774 that addressed this issue. In recent years, scholars have interpreted the decision to have held that there never was a common law copyright and that therefore the origin of copyright was strictly statutory. This reading departs from the conventional view of the case, and I aim to show in my paper that this modification is incorrect. The record from this period instead, I believe, supports the idea that authors held an inherent property right in their works that was protected at common law. Now, because Donaldson v. Becket is so important, much of what we will discuss this evening concerns how one interprets and determines the reasoning of a House of Lords decision from the late 18th century. Now, because I plan to speak for about 45 minutes, let's start with an outline of my presentation so that you can see where we are heading. First, as part of this introduction, I will begin by defining what I mean by a common law copyright. Next, I will discuss why copyright history, and specifically the origin of copyright law, continues to be important today. Then I will quickly introduce you to the two principal accounts of Donaldson v. Becket and the origins of copyright in England in 1774. The first is the traditional or conventional interpretation of that case, and the second is the modified account put forward by Howard Abrams and Ronan Deasley. In part two, before turning to Donaldson v. Becket in earnest, I will briefly describe the regulatory framework that governed copyrights before 1800. This will help hopefully place common law copyright in context for those of you who are not already familiar with it. We will then turn in detail in part three to Donaldson, with my aim here being to describe the manner in which the case was heard in the House of Lords, the types of records it generated, and the various perceptions of the decision. Lastly, in part 4, I will describe in greater detail the modified interpretation of Donaldson put forward by my friends, Howard and Ronan, and then offer my response to it. Ultimately, again, my aim is to refute or at least call into question this modified account of Donaldson. Now, from time to time during this presentation, I will project on the overhead screen some relevant court documents and other records. And finally, I should note that although this presentation concerns copyright, it is also very much about the records of decisions in the House of Lords and the difficulty that historians encounter in researching these types of cases. So let's begin by taking a moment, to define what I mean by a common law copyright. First, as to its source, I mean, of course, a copyright that exists without the need of a statute, regulation, or royal patent to support it. This is a copyright that judges would recognize as a natural or customary right inherent in authors. Additionally, the phrase common law copyright often describes two separate but related rights. The first is that an author has a right to prevent the unauthorized first printing and publication of a work. So, for example, if I were to give a copy of these manuscript notes to Elena and she printed and published them without my permission, she would violate that right. The second sense is that an author has a continuing right, even after first publication, to control the further printing and publication of the work. So to continue the example, even if I had already published my notes, Elena would not be able to reproduce them without my permission. That is to say, she could not argue that my act of publishing these notes dedicated them to the public domain. Tonight, when I speak of common law copyright, I usually mean for it to include both of those rights together. So why is English copyright history and the notion of a common law copyright in particular still important today? Well, for one, in terms of current law in the United States at least, which is where I work, there actually remain a number of areas where case law of this vintage can directly influence copyright doctrine. Historical antecedents remain relevant because judges in the United States are required, or at least advised in certain instances, to consult English legal history in deciding the questions that are presented to them. As strange as it may seem, 18th century English case law is often more important in the United States than it is in England. And this largely stems from our Supreme Court's penchant in the U.S. for originalist interpretation, and from the fact that many individual states adopted English common law as the common law of those states. So, for example, sound recordings fixed before 1972 are usually only protected, if at all, as a matter of state common law. And thus, we still see state courts today citing English cases from the 18th century to help assess whether to recognize a common law right in these recordings. The U.S. Supreme Court has also cited 18th century English sources when deciding constitutional issues, such as whether copyright litigants have a right to a jury trial on statutory damages, whether Congress can increase the duration of copyright beyond life of the author plus 50 years for pre-existing works, and whether Congress can resurrect copyrights in works that have previously fallen into the public domain. But another reason English copyright law of this vintage remains important is because it currently plays a supporting role in normative arguments in the United States over the proper scope of copyright. Copyright history is often used as a crutch or a rhetorical device during policy debates among scholars and lobbyists, with the thinking being, as Justice Holmes once stated in another context, that a page of history is worth a volume of logic. Additionally, Donaldson v. Beckett and other late 18th century cases garner significant attention because they were decided in the years before the adoption of the Copyright Clause of the U.S. Constitution in 1787, and that clause actually empowered Congress to enact a federal copyright act, and before the first federal Copyright Act, of 1790, which was based in large part on the Statute of Anne. Indeed, one of the framers of the Constitution suggested during the ratification debates that the basis of the Copyright Clause might have been drawn from the Law of Great Britain. This is an incredibly controversial point, but there's no question as to what was said. Interpretation, obviously, is open. James Madison wrote in the Federalist Papers that the utility of this power to enact a federal copyright statute will scarcely be questioned. The copyright of authors has been solemnly adjudged in Great Britain to be a right of common law. So in short, unlike cases decided on the subject decades after 1790, Donaldson and other late 18th century cases offer contemporaneous evidence of what the framers and the first Congress of the United States may have known and intended for U.S. copyright policy. This is, incidentally, why I limit the window of inquiry in this paper to the late 18th century and do not consider developments that occurred decades later. Now, at the heart of the debate these days is, of course, whether to treat copyright more like a natural or customary property right protected at common law, or as a privilege that was created solely by statute. These viewpoints carry hefty baggage because they set the default basis of the right. The first viewpoint suggests that copyright was designed principally to protect authors and their assigns in their works. The second, on the other hand, that it was designed principally to promote the public interest. Depending on which side one takes, it can affect any number of current policy issues, including, to give just four examples, whether copyright protection should depend on an author first registering her work, whether legislatures should continue to enlarge the statutory duration of copyright. As Howard pointed out in an article recently, Mexico is life plus 100 years, is that right?
That's correct.
Life plus 100. Maybe we should all be doing that. No. Whether we should be more or less inclined to grant injunctive relief against copyright infringers, and whether we should criminalize more thefts of the property inherent in copyrighted works. Lastly, I would be remiss if I did not mention that the original purpose of Anglo-American copyrights is especially important now in the United States because we are moving to what could soon become a comprehensive re-examination of U.S. copyright law. 2 years ago, the director of the U.S. Copyright Office urged Congress to begin this long and arduous process of revamping our copyright law, and the initial steps of that process are now underway. Notably, in anticipation of, and sometimes in reaction to this event, scholars and special interest groups, in the United States have written policy papers and books invoking the original purpose of copyright in England and the United States with a view to influencing policymakers in Congress on various issues. This one, for example, was written on behalf of the Center for Individual Freedom, a conservative think tank, and it was written in part by Paul Clement and some of his co-counsel. He's the former Solicitor General of the United States. So some heavy hitters have been engaged to write about this. Now, academics and judges and other lawyers, of course, have been examining the origins of copyright for quite some time. For over 250 years, in fact. And two sort of principal theories have emerged when we're focusing again just on the late 18th century. The conventional view on the historical question, according to late 18th century sources on English law that opine on the matter, was that the origin of copyright was as a common law right that existed independent of the 1710 statute. This view largely stemmed from two reported cases. The first is Miller v. Taylor, a King's Bench decision from 1769, which held that a common law right based on property principles existed independent of that statute of Anne that I mentioned earlier, and was not abridged or taken away by that statute's limited copyright durations. So therefore, copyright in England was deemed to be perpetual, to last forever. The second case is Donaldson v. Beckett, a House of Lords decision from 1774, which overturned Miller. There, the court held that copyrights in published works were governed solely by the 1710 statute and its limited durations. The House was not required to decide if a common law right predated the statute, but a majority of the judges who advised the Lords opined that a right did exist before 1710, but that the statute preempted it. On the basis of these judges' views, succeeding generations have taken Donaldson to directly or indirectly endorse, particularly when read in combination with Miller, that there was an antecedent right in authors. Now, this conventional view of the origin of copyright has garnered sharp criticism in recent years from two of my colleagues. One, of course, again, is Howard Abrams, a law professor from the University of Detroit, who wrote an important article on the subject in 1983. And the second is Ronan Deasley, a professor here actually at the University of Glasgow, who has written on the subject in a number of articles and a few books from, I think it was 2003 to about 2006. These scholars argue that the various treatise writers and judges in the late 18th century and many other writers in the years beyond have misread Donaldson, that in fact the House of Lords as a body actually held that copyright never existed at common law and that the origin of copyright was strictly legislative. As I will explain in greater detail in a later part of my work, Abrams and Deasley support their viewpoint by arguing, in part, that the most widely circulated accounts of the case misreported it, and that readers of the case have, in any event, often misunderstood how the House of Lords actually ruled on appeals in 1774. This modified account of Donaldson has been quite influential, and deservedly so. Most copyright scholars in the United States have adopted it, and many scholars in the UK have as well. Indeed, I even counted myself among the converts until recently when I was doing, obviously, the research for this paper. Now, before we jump into the details of Abrams and Deasley's interpretation of Donaldson and my response to it, let's take that step back and begin with the basic regulatory framework that governed copyrights in England before the year 1800. I suspect that many of you in the audience may not be familiar with it. So, for many years in England, namely from 1566 to 1695, with a few gaps in between, there was a patchwork of decrees, ordinances, and statutes that prohibited copyright infringement. None of these regulations limited copyright's durations, so copyrights in a given work were, while regulated, perpetual. After the demise of the last of the regulations in 1695, publishers claimed that the common law continued to protect their copyrights. By their lights, authors had always held perpetual property rights in their works, and the various regulations that had existed for so many years simply operated on top of the common law. Now, despite their claims of a pre-existing common law copyright, a publisher still campaigned after 1695 for a return to statutory protection. Depending on who one believes, this was done either because those publishers knew that in truth they held no common law rights, or because the publishers were unhappy with the remedy the common law provided, which was ordinary damages, and they instead preferred remedies such as penalties and forfeitures, which only statutory provisions could provide. In response, Parliament enacted the Statute of Anne, which came into force on the 10th of April, 1710. The statute included the penalties and forfeitures that the booksellers wanted, but its terms were limited. As I mentioned previously, it protected books for a maximum of 28 years from publication. Unfortunately, Parliament left it unclear whether it intended to preserve a pre-existing form of common law copyright, if any such right ever existed. And much of this confusion stemmed from a savings clause, which stated as follows: "Nothing in this act contained shall extend or be construed to extend either to prejudice or confirm any right that the universities of Cambridge or Oxford or any of them or any person or persons have or claim to have to the printing or reprinting any book or copy already printed or hereafter to be printed. Now, eventually, it fell to the courts of Great Britain to address three principal issues. First, did a common law copyright exist independent of the Statute of Anne? If so, did an author or her assigns lose that right once a work was first published? Stated another way, did the authorized publication of a work dedicate it to the public domain? And lastly, if an author did not lose the right upon publication, did the statute preempt or take away the right, or did the statute simply augment the common law remedies for the limited times stated therein? It was not until 1769 in Miller v. Taylor that these issues were fully addressed. As I already noted, the King's Bench in Miller held that there was a common law right, that it extended beyond the first publication of a work, and that the Statute of Anne did not preempt or take away that right. This was the state of things when the House of Lords decided Donaldson v. Becket in 1774. Now, Donaldson began as a lawsuit filed actually in the Court of Chancery in 1771. The statutory copyright of the book at issue had expired, and thus the only way the work could remain protected was at common law. Relying on that previous case, Miller v. Taylor, the Lord Chancellor held for the plaintiff and granted a perpetual injunction against the infringer. That case was then appealed to the House of Lords, which voted to reverse the decree of the Court of Chancery. Now, all scholars agree that the House of Lords, at a minimum, ruled that published works were subject to the Statute of Anne and its limited 28-year durations. Where we part ways is on the reasoning of the case. Why did the House rule that way? And because our disagreement turns crucially on the procedures of the House, and on the weight to give to certain records in the case, I think it'd be best for us to first discuss those procedures and records. So the House of Lords wore multiple hats. It played, of course, a role in enacting legislation. But at this period of time, it also sat as the final court of appeal in cases from Ireland, Scotland, and England. Of particular importance to us, the House heard appeals taken from the Court of Chancery of England. An appeal would commence when a party filed a petition in the House of Lords. The House would read that petition and then order the respondent to put in an answer, which was usually done pro forma. The House would then next appoint a day to hear the arguments of counsel on both sides. A few days before the argument, 4 days and to be precise at least, the counsel on both sides were required to submit printed cases to each other and to the House. These cases were not identical to the appellate briefs or submissions of today, but they did contain the background of the case and summaries of the reasons, they call them, or arguments being made on either side. The appeal would then be argued orally at the bar of the House by two barristers, or in some cases advocates, of course, that were allowed on each side. At the time of the appeal in Donaldson, the House was made up of 206 lords. You can see here, this is an image from the reign of Queen Anne. It didn't basically change much, if at all, by the time Donaldson v. Becket was heard. Now, of the 206 lords, only three were law lords, a term usually used to describe lords who previously or concurrently were judges on one of the superior courts of England, namely the Court of Chancery, the King's Bench, Common Pleas, or Exchequer. Now, because most of the lords were lay lords who had little or no legal training, the House had the option of summoning additional legal assistance from the judges who normally sat in the King's Bench, Common Pleas, or Exchequer. Now, in 1774, that amounted to 12 judges who could lend a hand. If the lords sought this help, they would summon the judges and ask them one or more questions about the law. The judges would then answer the questions, sometimes on the spot, sometimes at a later date, after the judges had consulted with each other, after one or more consultations. Often, the judges also offered their reasons for their answer. That is to say, they proffered actually opinions supporting their answers to the questions. After receiving these answers, and possibly opinions, the lords would then debate the matter. At this stage, it was usual for one or more lords to offer a speech explaining why he thought a case should be affirmed or reversed. Often, it was one of the law lords who would lead the way in urging his colleagues to vote one way or the other. After the debate concluded, the question was always formally put as one to reverse. This was done to ensure that if there was a tie in the votes, the lower court's judgment would stand. The House would then vote by undertaking either a division or by a simple collective voice vote. In the case of a voice vote at this time, all those in favor of reversing would collectively say content, followed by all of those against who would collectively say not content. After the vote, then, a corresponding judgment would be entered in the journals of the House of Lords. Typically, this judgment was very short, stating only that the case was reversed or affirmed. The judgment in Donaldson actually provides an excellent example of this brevity. It stated the following after the preambular provisions. It is ordered and adjudged by the Lords Spiritual and Temporal and Parliament Assembly that the said decree complained of in the said appeal be and the same is hereby reversed. Now, I've just covered a lot, so before we move on, let's just review the various components of an appeal, those components that came after the petition and answer. And they included, again, so you had your printed cases and then oral arguments of counsel. You had the questions of the lords to the judges, if any. You had the answers of the judges to any questions. You possibly had the opinions of the judges supporting their answers. And then you had the debate of the House, which included the speeches of those lords who chose to speak. And then there was the vote and judgment of the House. This brings us to our next topic, which is the records of proceedings. The Journal of the House of Lords was the only official memorial of the proceedings of the House. I have already told you, of course, that the Journal recorded the judgments of the House in appeal cases. The Journal also usually contained additional information about a case, but unfortunately not much more. For example, in cases where the judges were summoned for advice, the Journal would often record the questions that were asked, the judges' answers to those questions, but oftentimes the answers are really quite brief, and this is just an example from Donaldson itself. Importantly, the journals did not record any aspect of the debates of the lords, so we have no official record of what the lords actually said during the debate, nor do we have any articulated reasons for why the House voted as it did. But what about other records, unofficial records? They did exist, but as a general matter, they were usually scarce. As many of you probably already know, it was a breach of the privilege of the House of Lords to report on its proceedings. In 1774, this prohibition still existed. Now, to be sure, the House at this time had begun to tolerate the practice of reporting its proceedings. But tolerant was all the House really was. They still made it difficult to report the cases. For one, there was no place for a reporter to sit in the House of Lords. You would have to stand below the bar of the House if there was room. Second, the taking of notes was prohibited, so most reporters and others in the audience would have to rely on their memory and only begin to write down what they heard when they left the House of Lords. Donaldson, the case, overcame these obstacles, and numerous unofficial accounts reached the public. Nearly all of them are newspapers. Several papers from London and Edinburgh in particular published original reports of the proceedings, and numerous other papers, close to 50, reprinted them, thereby disseminating news of the case throughout the United Kingdom and Ireland as well. A few consolidated standalone accounts of the case also appeared in print, but they too were almost entirely based on prior newspaper accounts. So let's return now to what actually occurred in the appeal in Donaldson. The judges were summoned and asked five questions. The three that we care most about were essentially as follows. First, did an author have a right at common law to prevent an unauthorized first publication of a book or literary composition? Second, if so, did an author lose that right upon first publication, or could she continue to control further publication of the work? And then three, if a right at common law existed or hypothetically existed, did the statute of Anne abridge or take it away, preempt it? The two other questions, which I have not reproduced here, restated the first three in a slightly different form. Now, the Journal of the House of Lords recorded the answers of the 11 judges who participated as follows. 8-3 for a common law right before first publication. 7-4 for a common law right after first publication. And 6-5 that the statute preempted or abridged that common law right. Notably, according to the journal, Justice Nares of the Court of Common Pleas opined that there was a common law right, but that the statute preempted it. And his name is important, and Justice Nares, again, and we'll come back to him in just a moment. So in sum, then, the judges had effectively recommended that the House reverse the decree of the Court of Chancery. And as you'll recall, the Chancery had granted the plaintiff an injunction based on the common law that would last forever. The day after the judges finished offering their views, the House of Lords debated the matter. Five lords spoke, two of whom were law lords, and three of whom were not. We do not, unfortunately, have time to discuss each speech in detail, but it is unquestionably true that a majority of the five argued that there never was a common law right in published works before 1710. Some of them also argued that even if there had been a perpetual common law right before the statute of Anne, that statute abridged it. At the close of the debate, the House voted, again, to reverse the decree, and they did so by taking a collective voice vote. 84 lords were in attendance that day, according to the journal, and unfortunately, we do not know how many of the 84 lords actually voted, and of those who did vote, we do not know why they voted to reverse. Again, the lords were not asked to explain themselves. They were only asked to decide whether to reverse or not. So, how did judges and legal treatise writers perceive Donaldson during the late 18th century? If one looks at the cases and published treatises during those time periods, four readings emerge. First, a relative few thought that the House had affirmatively rejected the idea that a common law right predated the Statute of Anne. Second, a much larger group, which included Justice Blackstone, read the holding of Donaldson narrowly. In his commentaries on the laws of England in 1775, he wrote that the House held that once a work was published, it was governed solely by the durational terms of the Statute of Anne. Notably, Justice Blackstone was one of the 11 judges who had advised the Lords in Donaldson. A third, also large group, essentially used Blackstone as a point of departure, concluding that the House had not determined the origin of copyright. They looked instead to the holding in Miller, the judges in Donaldson, and sometimes the speeches of the Lords in Donaldson, in trying to assess whether English law recognized an antecedent common law right. And performing that review, nearly everyone thought that the law did, for again, focusing on these sources. A fourth and final perspective also emerged, albeit not really until early in the 19th century, so it's a little outside my window. Some observers read Donaldson to mean that the House of Lords as a body actually held in favor of an antecedent common law right. Now, my friend Ronan Deasley has demonstrated through his research that the third and fourth perspectives had percolated through the published cases and literature in the late 18th century and the early 19th centuries and came to predominate over the other perspectives. Thus, the conventional but not authoritative, the conventional but not the authoritative view on the matter during the aforementioned periods was that the origin of copyright in 18th century England was a common law right and not solely a creature of statute. So let's look closer now to Abrams and Deasley's argument. As I already suggested, in their work, they argued that the only correct reading of the case is the first one. That is to say, the House of Lords is a body held against an antecedent common law right. But why? Their argument comprises two parts. First, they argue that the official journal of the House of Lords misreported the views of one of the judges, Justice Nares, on the third question, and that this mistake has led, in part, to widespread misinterpretation of the decision for over 200 years. Relying in large part on work done previously on this point by John Witcher and Mark Rose, who is here today, Abrams and Deasley argue that Justice Nares actually opined that there was a common law right, but that the statute did not preempt it. As a consequence, the tally on that third question should have actually been recorded as follows. Ultimately, then, my friends conclude that a majority of the judges, 6-5, had in fact recommended that the House affirm the decree of the Court of Chancery rather than reverse it. So how has this mistake led people to misinterpret Donaldson? Because students of the case have always believed that the judges advised the House to reverse, and the House then did reverse, this also created in readers of the case an impression that the House had also followed the reasoning of the majority of the judges. Abrams and Deasley argue, however, that the corrected tally demonstrates that this was not necessarily true. The House had, in fact, rejected the advice of the majority of the 11 judges. That is to say, under the revised view of what actually happened, the judges recommended that the House affirm, but the House actually ended up reversing. So let's turn now to the factual evidence on this point, on this tally. My friends support the revised tally by crediting some of the unofficial accounts mentioned previously over the official journal of the House of Lords. Take, for example, one of the standalone accounts I mentioned earlier in this lecture. That account stated as follows. Justice Nares stated to the House why he thought a common law right in literary property did exist and why the statute of Queen Anne did not take it away. A second standalone account, which I will not reproduce here, stated something similar. And additionally, a number of newspaper reports that Mark Rose discovered also suggested that the clerk in the House of Lords had misreported Justice Nares. Now, as I mentioned earlier in this evening, after I read all of the scholarship written by my colleagues, I too found myself convinced that the Journal of the House of Lords had misreported Justice Nares. But as sometimes happens with archival work, while conducting research for another paper many years ago, I stumbled on a few documents that led me to question whether the unofficial accounts were in fact correct. And so I embarked on trying to uncover and read every extant primary source discussing the case. To that end, I first tried to find every surviving newspaper from the period in Scotland and England and Ireland. I also looked in the US to see if they reported anything on Donaldson that might shed light on Justice Nares' views. It took many research trips to England and Scotland to accomplish. I was happy to do it, by the way. Because even though many 18th century newspapers are available online today, a benefit I want to stress that my colleagues did not enjoy when they wrote their scholarship. Many of the papers actually were not online when I started this project, so I had to look at them in person anyway. And of course, many old newspapers still are not online today. They should be, but they're not. Eventually, I ended up finding over 50 contemporaneous periodicals with information on the appeal. And you can see I've just listed some of these. Hopefully that's somewhat legible. Additionally, I sought out, of course, every other printed source and manuscript that might characterize the positions of the judges. And I ended up finding a number of sources that my friends were not aware of, in addition to the newspaper reports, including some manuscript correspondence, manuscript annotations on extant printed cases, and even manuscript notes of legislators who sat on a related matter in the House of Commons soon after the case. Ultimately, when I combined all of the new primary sources, I was able to determine that the unofficial sources were actually mistaken on the Nares point and that the official record was most likely the correct one. To determine this, I first discovered, with the aid of course, my predecessors, that what appeared to be several independent newspaper and standalone accounts corroborating the revised Nares tally, they were actually accounts all stemming from a single newspaper story in the Morning Chronicle. The Morning Chronicle was the first paper to publish a narrative of the relevant proceedings. Figuring this out, that everything was copied from everything else, was incredibly time-consuming because I had to collate, and sorry, this isn't very legible, I had to collate all the various newspaper, periodical, and other accounts of the case. So I had to read everything more than once because I have a terrible memory. Second, I was then able to determine that the author of the single newspaper story, the progenitor of the revised account, if you will, was himself mistaken. And principally, I did this by finding statements in various records from several lawyers who argued the case on both sides. And their statements supported the orthodox 6-5 tally. By way of example, Arthur Murphy, who was one of the counsel for the Donaldsons on the appeal and in this related matter, stated the following less than a month after the appeal. In the House of Lords, six of the judges were decisively of opinion that the decree against Donaldson ought to be reversed. And there were some others as well, but I won't project them on the screen. Now, it would be quite remarkable and unlikely, in my view, for the clerk in the House of Lords and counsel on both sides to be mistaken on this point. Rather, it seems to me that this is one of those many instances where a journalist has just misreported the legal proceedings. Now, the fact that the reporter of the Chronicle was likely mistaken is not surprising. He heard four opinions on the day that Justice Nares spoke, spanning the course of about 2 hours, but he could not write down a single word until he returned to his establishment. The clerk of the House, on the other hand, of course, could write as much as he pleased during the proceedings. So in the end, it appears that a majority of the judges did in fact agree with the majority of the speaking lords that the House should reverse, albeit not on the very same grounds. So on the one hand, the majority of the advising judges thought that a common law right did exist, but that the statute preempted it or abridged it. And on the other hand, the majority of the five speaking lords thought that a common law right had never existed in published works. And some of them went on to further state that if there was a common law right, the statute abridged it. So what then is the reasoning behind the decision to reverse? This brings us to the second argument and reason that Abrams and Deasley believe that Donaldson has been misinterpreted. Offered as an independent ground to the first, my friends argued that the advice of the judges is actually a red herring and irrelevant because in point of law and procedure, the speeches of the five lords constituted the reasoning of the House. To quote my friends, the judges' opinions were only advisory, but the Lord's statement were the law of the case or the holding of the case. In essence, my friends argue that certain rules or doctrines in 1774 dictated that the speeches of the Lords, when made on the winning side, constituted the reasons of the entire House. Stated another way, the five speaking Lords of the 84 who were there that day decided the case, not the House as a whole, and consequently we must disregard the advice offered by the judges and the fact that many other Lords potentially voted on the appeal. I believe this to be incorrect for a number of reasons. First, it is difficult in this context to consider the speaking lords, even when they were law lords, as any different from the judges, given that the Lord's speeches were just as advisory as the judges' opinions. The rest of the house was free to side against their brethren, against the speakers, and lay lords could even cause the house to rule against the wishes of the law lords, which is something that actually happened in other appeals on either side of Donaldson. As Edward Sugden noted many years later, the lords are entitled to require the judges to give them their opinions, which opinions are to instruct and guide them, although they are not binding on them. Now, the law lords can both advise the House and vote in favor of their own views, but their opinions are no more binding on the House than the opinions of the learned judges. The time at which the speeches were made also bears this out. The lords spoke before the vote, not after, because the speeches served to explain why a lord planned to vote a particular way and to urge his colleagues to do the same. Indeed, speakers would not necessarily know whether they would end up in the majority. It just seems hard to imagine, in my view, that the speaking lords always expected their speeches to represent the holding of the House, particularly when the case was contentious and drew the opinions of the judges, which, of course, is what occurred in Donaldson. Additionally, if the speeches were thought to be paramount, as my friends argue, one would have expected House procedures to not hinder their dissemination. And yet the opposite was true. Members of the public were not permitted to take notes of the speeches, and no one was allowed to publish them. To be sure, speeches, of course, were sometimes published, perhaps even with the help of a lord, but this occurred in a haphazard way and not in observance of an expressed rule that the speech would constitute the reasons of the whole House. In any case, apart from a few slips, these prohibitions were actually very successful. At the time of Donaldson, there had been only one published collection of appeals and writs of error in the House of Lords, and the House had actually reprimanded the original publisher of this back in the late 17th century. Thereafter, no new collection of parliamentary cases was published, whether authorized or not, until Josiah Brown gave us the first book of his multi-volume series in 1779. With a few exceptions, he too omitted the speeches of the lords. The next sets of parliamentary reports in 1789, 1803, and 1807 operated under similar conventions. Indeed, it was not until 1814 that reports regularly included the speeches of the lords. Remarkably, the only thing that the Lord's Journal thought worthy of reporting publicly, apart from the brief judgments I mentioned earlier, were the answers of the judges. Now, with respect to cases decided in 1774, I think the most that one can say is that because the House usually ruled as the law lords advised, be it to affirm, reverse, or vary, we should presume that the House also followed the reasoning of the law lords as expressed in their speeches. Now, law lords, again, as contrasted with lay lords, merited special reverence due to their legal training and experience. But this presumption, if one can call it that, seems most helpful in instances where the lords heard an appeal or writ of error without the assistance of the judges. This follows because in cases like Donaldson, where the judges were summoned, we encounter a like presumption that the House usually followed the judges. So, about 100 years before Donaldson, Chief Justice Hale stated the following: "Since the time that the whole decision of errors had been practiced in the House of Lords by their votes, the judges have been always consulted, and their opinion held so sacred that the lords have ever conformed their judgments thereunto. Though for many years last past, they have had only voices of advice and assistance, not authoritative or decisive, yet their opinions have been always the rules whereby the lords do or should proceed in matters of law." Now, this, of course, was 100 years before Donaldson, so I checked the records of mid to late 18th century to see whether this remained true or not, and it did. There are actually very few instances where the House defied the judges. By my count, from 1730 to 1800 inclusive, the judges offered advice in 83 appeals and writs of error. But in only four, Do the records show the House voting in a manner inconsistent with the views of the judges? And in three of those cases, the vote also went against the majority of the law lords. So it's really only one case where they ended up defying the judges and following the law lords in that sense. Now, the manner in which appeals were heard in the House of Lords eventually changed in such a way as to support the rule advanced by my friends, but not for many years. In 1823, toward the end of Lord Eldon's tenure, it became usual for the law lords to decide appeals without the rest of the House. A few lay peers would attend to reach the required quorum of three, but they typically would not vote. By the late 1830s, the House counted seven law lords among its members, and their numbers were often enough to sit without the need of any lay peers. Thus, in 1839, James Stuart wrote that it is not now the practice of the whole body of the House to attend to its judicial business. This is usually transacted entirely by the Lord Chancellor, speakers, or other peers who have at one time filled judicial situations. Now, even still, it was not until 1844 that the convention was established that lay lords should never vote on appellate matters. It was only with these changes, combined with proper reporting, that one could expect that the lords who spoke were the ones who decided the appeal, and that their words reflected the reasoning of the House. Stated another way, the speeches were no longer advisory, but became more akin to judgments of a court. So what then is the correct way, in my view, to describe the holding in Donaldson? It's as follows. The House of Lords held that published works were subject to the durational terms of the Statute of Anne, but the reasoning of the decision cannot be determined. In advising the House, a number of judges and lords offered their own views of the matter, but none of them singly or in combination establishes why the House ruled as it did. Nevertheless, they do stand as guidance on what the law was at the time. You could perhaps consider it as sort of a form of dicta or something like that. Now, as I've already noted, it was common for observers in the late 18th century to read Donaldson and Miller as predominating in favor of an antecedent right. This is not surprising in my view. On the strict interpretation of Donaldson, Miller remained relevant. And if you combine the views of the judges and law lords from both cases, ultimately you have a majority who believed that there was a common law copyright before publication, a slim majority believed that it was not lost upon publication, and another majority believed that the Statute of Anne preempted at least some of those antecedent rights. Now, that what I've just described there, of course, is purely quantitative, just adding up various views. In the minds of some observers, of course, there was a qualitative component where maybe they're considering the gravitas of one of the judges who's given an opinion or something like that. But nevertheless, on the whole, when you actually look at the various published sources in the late 18th century, there is support for the idea that authors held a natural or customary property right protected at common law. And that's it.
Okay, well, thank you very much indeed, Thomas. That was a fabulous lecture. I'm now going to turn to the floor for questions. We're actually recording this session. We're keen to make it publicly available later. So I'd be grateful. We've got Shona's going to bring around the mic. If you could wait to have the mic in your hands before you ask your question, and perhaps introduce yourself, just briefly name and affiliation. Okay, questions. Start with Martin Kretschmer, who perhaps needs no introduction here.
That's my privilege today. Just had a thought, would there be any science in the market? Would there be any science in the market after the decision whether a common law persisted or not? So would you...
Science in the market before this decision?
Oh, afterwards.
Afterwards.
Yeah, so...
But
the nature of damages, the nature of remedies...
Yes, there was, of course, after the decision, even if you interpret it as recognizing or at least indirectly endorsing a common law right, the decision said that that right was taken away. So going forward, everyone knew that the copyrights that they held had either already expired or would expire after the statutory terms. So the reaction of the market was to actually seek a new statute, right? The booksellers of London in particular wanted, well, it ended up being 14 years, but when they first asked for it, they didn't say how long. So that was one market reaction. But then what was the, I think you were maybe getting at something else. Oh, sorry.
I assume if over time a particular view that a particular view of the persistence of a common law, I mean, would resurface.
Right. So after the, if you look at the late 18th century, there were a few more cases that touched on the common law right, and one of them is, as you mentioned before, this idea of remedies. Right. So, for example, can you get, even after the statute of Anne, a common law ordinary damages remedy? Because the statute of Anne just had penalties and forfeitures. It didn't have common law remedies. And there was a decision from the King's Bench that ultimately said, yes, you can get common law damages. And they did discuss Donaldson. And in that case, the Chief Justice basically adopted the conventional view that the law had settled now, that there previously had been a common law copyright, but that the statute had taken away some of those rights. And ultimately, though, they found that the statutory remedies, penalties and forfeitures, were actually inadequate, which is a little bit weird, but they offered some reasons. And so that's one of the reasons they allowed a common law damages remedy. Now, Ronan, in his book, spends a lot more time getting into developments that occurred after the year 1800. So there were lots of cases that were reported, of course, dealing with various forms of copyright, and there were lots of treatises on copyright that were written. And at least the treatise writers, according to Ronan, correct me if I'm wrong, he's mostly, again, thinks that they've adopted the sort of conventional or traditional view that there was a common law right. Certainly not uniform. No one was saying that it was absolutely authoritative. And many of you in this room probably know that in 1854, the House of Lords revisited this issue and basically said, there is no common law copyright. But that's, you know, many years past the window that I'm focusing on.
Okay, so, Lionel Bennett.
Sorry. Lionel Bennett.
I better put my drink down for the night.
I have an opportunity to ask you questions tomorrow morning, but I wanted to ask you something now, which is prompted really by us being in Scotland discussing this issue. And my question is, have you thought about the... So I don't really agree with, as I'll have an opportunity to say tomorrow, your view that this effectively restores the conventional view as to common law copyright. But I wondered whether you had thought about to what extent the House of Lords decision could be read as saying anything about common law copyright in Scotland, given that Hinton and Donaldson had decided there was no common law copyright in Scotland just in 1773. So that's my question.
Yeah, it's a question that I asked Hector McQueen back in August. Remember that email? Because I wondered the same thing. And I don't want to misrepresent, maybe you've changed your mind, but my recollection was that you said, and I agreed with the fact that it would not affect Scots law. So if the House of Lords had actually affirmed in Donaldson v. Becket and therefore recognized that there is a perpetual common law right in England, that would not have reversed or overturned Hinton v. Donaldson. It would require a case being appealed, another case later on, from Scotland to the House of Lords in order for that common law, Scots common law, to effectively be overturned. Statute, different, right? The statutory interpretation from the House of Lords, that would apply equally in England and Scotland, but in terms of common law, we'd have to wait for a decision to come up from the Court of Session.
I mean, I know nothing about this, really. But it strikes me that the House of Lords might well have been conscious that their decision would be read as both a ruling on the relationship of the Statute of Anne to Scottish common law as well as to English common law. And in holding that very narrowly, the statute of Anne did not apply, I think that that's an important gap. The statute of Anne preempted whatever rights there might exist.
Or it just applied. I mean, we don't know exactly.
It left that as a complete gap. And that's why I really don't think it restores the conventional.
Yeah, when I talk about the conventional wisdom or view, it's based on the published cases, again, so first focus in the late 18th century, right? So I'm looking basically at Miller v. Taylor and Donaldson v. Beckett, because those are the only cases that actually went to a full judgment, okay? So you look at those, and in addition, you look at all the various legal treatises written from that period that are looking at Miller v. Taylor and are looking at Donaldson v. Beckett. And when you look at those, it's much more common. In fact, the vast majority of them, when they address the issue of whether there was an antecedent common law right, they say that there was. And the way in which they reach that conclusion differs. So some people, they're focusing on Miller v. Taylor alone and maybe saying, well, look, it's still good law. You know, Donaldson may have weakened it, but there's still some component there. And other folks are looking at everything together. You could just imagine you put it all in a pot and you say, well, we've got some opinions from some judges, from Miller v. Taylor. We've got some speeches from the Lords and answers and opinions in Donaldson v. Beckett. And on the whole, just like I did at the end of my paper, you look at it and they say, it looks like the laws, they use the word settled, that there was an antecedent common law right. But I don't mean to represent when I say the conventional view was that this was the authoritative view, right? Now, could it be that there were other people who thought the exact opposite? Absolutely, right? I'm sure there were 50 lawyers who thought that it was not the case at all. But so when I say conventional, I'm just basing it on the published sources because that's what other people would look at later, right? So when people look back and say, so what was the rule likely in the late 18th century? They're going to look at the cases, and they're going to look at treatise writers. That's it, right? They're not going to look at, even though I did, you know, some letter that somebody wrote with their take on the case, right? I mean, if they're not a lawyer, right, they're most likely not. They're never going to find it. But they're not going to look to it. And that's what I meant. I wish that I had maybe clarified that a little bit more in my paper, but that's what I mean by conventional. And so when I say we were turning back to it, that's what I mean. It's sort of bookending the paper in that sense.
Thanks very much, Thomas. I hope I'm not deafening everyone in the room with this, or alternatively, you can't hear me at all. A very interesting paper, and I think the thing that I particularly welcome in it is the clarifications about procedure and so on, which I think are very important. And we are looking at things in a different world from the one in which we inhabit. And I'm sure we'll be discussing some of this tomorrow. And I may make one or two comments from the chair of the discussion session on some of the comments that have been made by the commenters, which I've had the privilege of seeing. But the thing that I want to ask tonight, because I fear I won't get the chance to abuse the privilege of the chair tomorrow, is this investigation, this in-depth investigation of procedure in the Lords, something that can also be applied in other aspects of this whole question? And the thing that strikes me, and I haven't looked at all the literature very recently, and I may be missing things, but I have a sense that the literature hasn't really explored the common law equity divide in English law at this time. And it, in particular, has not been clear exactly what we mean, and what may have been meant in the past by the phrase common law copyright, especially given that it was inequity this common law copyright was first in some sense recognized, and therefore it wasn't really common law at all. And the really significant thing about Miller against Taylor, as far as I can see from my north of the border position, where we don't divide common law and equity in this sort of way, is that that was the case where the common law came in and said, yes, there is a right here. A lot of divided opinion. It's not just a matter of equity putting straight a few things that are slightly wrong as a result of this statute. Mm-hmm. There is actually a definitive common law right which is capable of protection not only by the equitable remedies of injunction and so on, right. but also by the common law remedy of damages, if that is appropriate.
Right.
And what I'm really trying to get at here is what exactly is the underlying notion of common law equity? And how does it apply in this particular context? It struck me when I was doing my research on the Hinton against Donaldson that the notion of common law and equity in Scotland was vital to understanding what was happening in the decision of the Scottish judges. And that is why I also take the view that you expressed perfectly accurately a few minutes ago, that I don't think the decision in Donaldson would have been seen as decisive on any common law question. It would have been seen as decisive only in a Statute of Anne question, because the Statute of Anne was a statute as applicable in Scotland as it was in England. Mm-hmm. The common law in which the statute sat was a different common law, with a different notion of equity as somehow imbued in the law rather than as something separate from the law.
Right. Well, I agree with everything that you just said, so that was easy. But the common law equity divide, of course, played a central role in Miller v. Taylor. So for those of you who are not familiar with all the background, after the Statute of Anne was enacted in 1710, there came a point starting about 1731 where a number of lawsuits were being filed for copyright infringement in the Court of Chancery. Okay. And, of course, the Court of Chancery is a court of equity. And so the very earliest cases that were based on a common law copyright, okay, those were brought in the Court of Chancery. And the Court of Chancery granted interlocutory injunctions on those very early on. So when you fast forward to Miller v. Taylor in 1769, one of the questions that the judges argued about and were very divided about is what worth should we assign to those decisions in equity? Are they conclusive of the common law? Are they potentially probative? Are they completely irrelevant? And the same argument, incidentally, was raised in Donaldson v. Beckett. And the conclusion was, from when I read the case, all the judges who spoke on the issue recognized that these equity decisions could be probative in some part. But it's interesting because the judges actually disagreed on the standard required for granting one of those injunctions. Some of the judges said, well, look, when the judges granted those interlocutory injunctions back in the 1730s, they were doing it only because they thought that there was a reasonable pretense of title. Like there's a reasonable doubt. There may be, there may not be. So that was very inconclusive. Other judges in the same case, Miller v. Taylor and Donaldson v. Beckett, said, no, you guys don't understand the standard under which the Court of Chancery grants these injunctions. Chancellors only grant them when the title, the right, is indisputable, right? So clearly, if these judges, the chancellors, I misspoke, had been granting injunctions back then, it's because they thought that there really was a common law right. And so they go back and forth on this. And so some judges in Miller v. Taylor and Donaldson v. Beckett rely on those early chancery decisions, and other judges do not. Now, I mean, I can represent to you, because in Donaldson v. Beckett and I think in Miller v. Taylor, some of the judges, I think it was Justice Yates, he said, it's crazy that we are looking to a court of equity to determine an issue of common law, particularly when the case was sent to us from a court of equity. But this happened on a regular basis. So it was not uncommon for the Court of King's Bench, for counsel, and even for judges to cite to decisions from the Court of Chancery when they were deciding issues of common law. So there already was this essential, looking to the Court of Chancery as precedent. Again, not conclusive by any way, shape, or form, not at all, but it was something that they could consider. And, of course, it continued after Miller v. Taylor and Donaldson v. Beckett. So hopefully that responds to your question.
Okay, so for Bob and Laurie.
I was just wondering if through your research you had any, maybe just speculation as to what was actually, what was Lord Mansfield actually thinking in Donaldson?
Oh, you know, I don't know. I mean, right now I'm inclined to agree with Mark that some background. Chief Justice Mansfield of the Court of King's Bench had presided over Miller v. Taylor, and so he was very much a proponent of a common law copyright that persisted after the Statute of Anne. And when the case in Donaldson v. Beckett arose, I didn't get into this during the presentation, but you'll recall that I said that there were 12 judges who would have been available to assist the House of Lords. But then I said that only 11 judges participated. And one of the judges who did not was Chief Justice Mansfield. So even though he, of course, could participate as a judge, still being the Chief Justice of the King's Bench, and he was also a lord, and he didn't participate at all. And so it is this big mystery. Why didn't he speak up? Now, his views were already known, of course, because of his judgment in Miller v. Taylor. So we can only speculate, but I think there was some bad blood between Lord Mansfield and Lord Camden. It was, I think, essentially was his nemesis. And one of the things I discovered in doing some of the archival research, which I didn't know about before, was the fact that Lord Mansfield had effectively overruled Lord Camden in Miller v. Taylor. Because Camden, we've always thought for the longest time that some other Lord Chancellor handled all the proceedings in Miller v. Taylor. but then ultimately what ended up happening is Lord Camden came in. And so this is not in my presentation at all, it's in my paper. But there was, I think, some bad blood between the two, and he did not speak up. But I'll tell you, I've seen lots of correspondence, most of it manuscript, where people talk about the fact that he didn't say anything at all. And the booksellers of London, of course, were incredibly upset because he had supported their cause in Miller v. Taylor, and I mean, they wanted to kill him. They just couldn't believe it. Like, why didn't you say anything? But he didn't.
Questions? Yeah, Owen Bracha.
I'm Owen Bracha from the University of Texas, and I'm going to join the ranks of tomorrow's panelists who want to ask questions tonight. So my question is, what do you think that Donaldson versus Beckett, and indeed Miller v. Taylor as well, tell us, if at all, about the question of whether there really was common law copyright prior to 1710 as a live practice, as opposed to the question of whether there was an invented tradition of common law copyright that came into life by the end of the 17th century, beginning of the 18th century?
Yeah, that's a great question. So let me give a little bit of background for the rest of the audience. When the judges in Miller v. Taylor and Donaldson v. Beckett, the ones who supported an antecedent common law right, when they reached that conclusion, they did so without relying really on that many cases from before 1710. There were some relating to printing patents, and they relied on some of those. But they said numerous times, there are no other cases that have been filed before 1710, either at law or in equity. So it's very true when you look at the decision that they're sort of, they're kind of making it up, right? Now, it is what it is. They're saying that there is a common law copyright, and there always was a common law copyright. But when you look at it in terms of precedent, there really isn't a lot there that they could cite. Now, I actually agree with some of the things that they said. That's another paper. But yeah, it certainly looks like it was more of an invented tradition than one that was actually supported by custom before 1710. Now, that having been said, I am working on another paper, which I've been working on I don't know how many years, which is called Copyright at Common Law Before 1710. And there are cases. They're almost all in equity, though. And they're over 20, and they were filed during the various statutory interregnums. You'll recall I had this thing up here. Let's see here. Hold on a sec. We'll get there in just a second. Hope you're not getting dizzy. It is here, I hope. Where is this thing? Here we go. So you can see here what's in bold was when we had regulations that prohibited copyright infringement. And what's incredibly faint, too faint, is when we had statutory interregna. There was no statutory support for copyright. So if you have a lawsuit that's actually filed during one of those gaps, arguably, it's going to have to be based on a common law copyright. Now, it might be based on something else, a bylaw of the Company of Stationers or the custom of the City of London. But as it turns out, from the first gap, 1679 to 1685, and this last gap, 1695 to 1710, booksellers were filing lawsuits and getting injunctions, interlocutory injunctions, in the Court of Chancery based on a common law copyright. All right. Now, again, to Hector's point, common law, I mean, were they saying it was something that was that would be recognized in the common law courts? And the answer to that would be yes. And the reason we can say yes is because when they're filing some of these lawsuits, they're saying, I want an injunction now, here in the Chancery, and I want some discovery, because I'm going to the King's Bench tomorrow to get my damages. So they want a common law remedy at common law. So it's brought in Chancery for the equitable relief, but it's based on a common law right. But I'll also say I found a case in the Court of King's Bench filed during the statutory interregnum based on a common law copyright. It did not go to a judgment. But it's finding those cases is such a nightmare. I mean, it takes forever. Sorry.
Tell us, one more from Mark Rose. I will be in on tomorrow. One question. I believe that it was standard practice among the booksellers in the 17th century the stationers company booksellers, to collect conveyances from authors for their manuscripts, their books. And then those conveyances got used within the company as, in effect, title.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, would that have anything to say about the existence of a presumption of something like a common law copyright or not?
It's an arguable point. So you have, certainly you're correct, you have booksellers, and let's focus on during these statutory interregna, right, where they are acting as if they have a perpetual property right in their works. Whether we say it's based on common law or the custom of the City of London, who knows, but they certainly are acting like that. Maybe they were mistaken, right? Maybe they were just hoping. But yeah, I mean, there's certainly, and that was one of the points that I think the judges cited in Miller v. Taylor, is that people had been acting in the trade as if there had been, there was a perpetual copyright, and so that adds some legitimacy to the argument that there had always been, or at least for some time. Of course, there are problems with that argument. Not every argument was perfect on either side of the debate, and so you could sit there and poke holes on both sides.
Okay, well, that concludes today. Thank you very much indeed, Tomas, and thank you for great questions from the crew.
Thank you.